Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
You know, I've referenced this on the program in the past, as that old saw of journalism, when a dog bites a man, that is not news. When a man bites a dog, that is in fact news. But sometimes I think there's value in the dog bites man stories, if only to illustrate why something is a pattern and isn't all that controversial, because it's just something we're used to having happen, such as the case today in Calgary, one of my favorite cities in this lovely dominion of ours. But in Calgary today, Justin Trudeau is visiting the Prime Minister of Canada. He met this morning with Premier Danielle Smith, and then he decided to, just about 30 minutes ago, start taking questions from reporters. But there are actually two reporters who are conspicuously absent from this gaggle, two mainstays in journalism in Alberta. One is Kian Bexty of the Counter Signal. The other is Rachel Emanuel, who you may know. She's been on this show. She has been a tremendous Alberta correspondent for True North, hosts Alberta Roundup, and has a very storied career despite her relatively young age, I mean, compared to me anyway, because she has worked in mainstream media newsrooms. She was at iPolitics. She worked for the Globe and Mail. She was educated in the hallowed halls of Carleton University's journalism program, just a few minutes down the road from Justin Trudeau's office. She is as credible a journalist as you can get in this country, probably more so, and yet she has been banned from covering Justin Trudeau's press conference. She sent me a picture of her out in the parking lot, hoping that maybe she'll get the chance. I shouldn't even say what she's, well, hopefully Trudeau's not listening. She's out in the parking lot while Justin Trudeau is in there, and this is Calgary in March. I mean, presumably she's very cold. I don't know. Kian presumably is cold as well, but he doesn't work for True North, so I'm more concerned about Rachel. But this is what's going to happen. Justin Trudeau is going to take his questions if he hasn't finished already. I bet not a single legacy media reporter is going to challenge him on what's happened. She just texted me. Rachel just said they kicked us out. So apparently she had made her way inside and then got kicked out. And I probably shouldn't share this. She said, I'm so puzzled. But apparently puzzled was an autocorrect, and she meant to say, I'm so pissed. Well, you absolutely should be, Rachel, because Justin Trudeau, I've had this experience before, so I can do that old meme thing where I say, oh, first time, because I was banned from covering Justin Trudeau's caucus retreat in my own city of London, Ontario, just a few months back, and they never gave me a reason. They just simply did not accredit me. When I have attempted to cover statements and announcements by Justin Trudeau in the past, what's happened has been, Sean, if you can get Rachel to dial in on the show, actually, because I can't carry on this text conversation with her. So see if we can get Rachel for a few minutes to connect here, assuming she's not in handcuffs and being thrown into the back of an RCMP cruiser. But if she wants to dial in from the back of an RCMP cruiser, she is more than welcome to. But I wasn't even going to talk about this, because as I said earlier, Justin Trudeau bans independent journalists from covering his press conference. That is sadly a dog bites man story now, because this is just par for the course from a government and a prime minister that does not want to answer a single question from a non-state approved media outlet. And by the way, that's quite literally the case. The federal government will oftentimes refer to their press conferences as only being available to members of the Parliamentary Press Gallery. Now, that is a group set up under the auspices of the Speaker of the House of Commons. It's self-regulating in the sense that journalists who are members are very cliquey often and decide who is going to join their ranks, but it is a body that is given a mandate by Parliament, effectively by the government. So when Justin Trudeau turns around and says, well, we'll only take questions from journalists that are a member of this group, they're setting up an arbitrary standard. They are setting up an arbitrary standard by which they get to decide who's in and who's out, because they kind of just know who the press gallery is not going to allow in, who the press gallery is not going to admit as a member. So this is quite disgraceful. It might not be all that surprising, but here you have a storied, well-respected, credible journalist in Alberta that is banned from asking a single question of the prime minister when he is literally in her own turf, when he is in Alberta. Now, Danielle Smith, the premier of Alberta, had a bit of a different approach. She met with Trudeau earlier today and on her way out stopped to take several questions from Rachel Emanuel, from Kian Bexie, from all those who had been relegated to the parking lot. The Danielle Smith, without her phalanx of bodyguards that Justin Trudeau had, just took a stroll and stopped and answered some questions. And you know what? Nothing bad happened. Nothing catastrophic happened, because when people go to the lengths that Justin Trudeau's staff go through to prevent you from answering questions, what they're really saying is that they don't trust their guy. They don't trust their candidate. They don't trust their prime minister to be able to answer these questions. Now, why this is actually relevant to the topic I was planning on leading off about in my monologue today is because we're talking about what government can do when it has a level of power and authority, the way that government can exercise its whims in a very arbitrary way, and the rest of us just have to go along with it. Now, why this is relevant is because the federal government right now is trying to push Bill C-63. I've been talking about it for the last 2 weeks. It's called the Online Harms Act. It does a number of things. Chief among them, in my view, it puts a new test for so-called hate speech into the Human Rights Code, where the government will be able to, through the Human Rights Tribunal, prosecute people for their speech, for so-called speech crimes, if they utter comments that are likely to foment, I always get my lopsided quote, I don't know why I do it, likely to foment, probably because I'm not seeing the mirror image, so when I try to move the left up at the right down, I don't know, now I look like I'm just milking a cow. The whole point of this is they're going to go after speech that is likely to foment detestation and vilification. And what that means is anyone's guess. Now, I put this question a couple of weeks back, and I want to share the clip because I think it's highly relevant here. I put it to Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre. This was before we saw the text of the bill, but we had news that it was coming down the pipeline. And he touched on why it is so dangerous for Justin Trudeau's government to have this power. Take a look.
Morning, Mr. Poilievre. Andrew Lawton, True North. The federal government has said that its online harms bill is imminent. They've said this bill will include, among other things, a ban on so-called online hate speech. As you know, the Conservatives a decade ago repealed Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act, which the Liberals have talked about reintroducing and tried in the last parliamentary term. Will the Conservatives oppose the reintroduction of these provisions and the Liberals' approach to so-called online hate speech?
Yes, we will oppose Justin Trudeau's latest attack on freedom of expression. And I want to ask, what does Justin Trudeau mean when he says the word hate speech? He means speech he hates. So, for example, let's go through some of the things he said is hate speech. Jerry Butts, the PMO puppet master, said that it was hate speech to criticize Trudeau for using the ridiculous term people kind, right? Justin Trudeau said anyone who criticized him during the pandemic was engaging in hate speech. Basically, anybody who disagrees with his radical agenda when it comes to kids, he says, is hate speech. He attacked Muslim parents who were protesting against his agenda. Is he going to criminalize those Muslim parents for protecting their children in schools? Go down the list of things that Justin Trudeau disapproves of, and you can imagine all of the things that will be criminalized. And then there becomes the question of who is going to be in charge of determining what is hate speech. Recently, a school board in Ontario banned Anne Frank's books. Okay? So would that be considered hate speech under Justin Trudeau's woke authoritarian agenda? I think it would. So anyone who thinks that speech they don't like is going to be criminalized and therefore the bill should be supported, go through that. Those people should go through the list of their own thoughts that Justin Trudeau considers to be unacceptable views, and you can assume that he will ban all of that as well. And finally, I point out the irony that someone who spent the first half of his adult life as a practicing racist who dressed up in hideous racist costumes so many times he says he can't remember them all, should then be the arbiter on what constitutes hate. Why doesn't he? What he should actually do is look into his own heart and ask himself why he was such a hateful racist, for despite his enormous personal privileges of a multi-million dollar trust fund, being the son of a prime minister, growing up in mansions, traveling the world, why he had so much hate in his heart that he was such an awful racist. And what he should do is actually explain where that ugliness came from, and maybe in that way, rather than through coercion, he could help in, us all in the fight against real hate. Thank you.
So why I shared that is twofold. Number one, I think that anything that infringes on free speech is wrong inherently on its own, because I believe free speech to be a good thing. I believe free speech to be a first principle, which means that anything should really be assessed against it and other first principles, by which I mean that if something is going to infringe free speech, well, therefore it's inherently wrong. But even if you accept that there are limitations that are required, and the limitation is naturally built in my view, and sort of the framework that I take on this, by other people's freedoms. When your speech is impeding other people's liberty, that is when it is there's an inherent check in that, because you can't have rights that are in contradiction. But at the risk of getting too into the weeds on political theory here, if you believe that free speech is not perhaps the inherent good that I think it is, that you could still argue this bill is bad because it gives government the power to very arbitrarily decide what speech is legitimate and what speech is not, what speech is hateful and what speech is not. And I actually had an idea, and we might do something on this, of just going around and surveying Canadians, and I don't even know if you need to do it in a scientific way, and asking them, give them a list of statements and say, is this hate speech? Is this hate speech? Is this hate speech? And I think you would actually be quite shocked by how many say that speech, expressions of speech, which are, in my view, legally legitimate, maybe not morally or substantively legitimate, but legally legitimate, would be by them, by a panel of Canadians, classed as hateful. Now, I wanted to talk about this poll here because there was a Léger poll reported on by the Canadian Press, which found that just under half of Canadians believe the federal government's plan to regulate social media sites will make them safer. A little over half find that they were agreed. They agreed fundamentally with the idea, with the premise that government needs to beef up, to strengthen sentences for people who have been found to have committed hate speech. This is what they're saying. So Canadians are split on this. We have effectively a coin toss. Half of Canadians are for it. Half of them are against it. Now, here's the thing. If you are the one hen in a colony of 99 foxes, democracy doesn't look that good. I mean, the majority will, of course, vote to eat you. But in the end, we are going to look at some things that are matters of fundamental right and wrong and not about democracy. And democracy is incredibly important, but you cannot majoritarianize your way, to make up a word here, away from fundamental rights, which means the majority does not have the right to trample on the free speech rights of the minority, whether it's a religious minority, a political minority, a sexual minority, whatever the case may be. But the problem is that politics is inherently majoritarian. And the question that I want to leave you with is whether we will have a society in which Canadians will willingly go to the government and say, I want you to take away my right to free speech. I want you to take away his right to free speech and her right to free speech. Remember during 2021, during COVID, when Justin Trudeau campaigned on violating the fundamental rights of people who weren't vaccinated. He campaigned, literally had rallies during the election campaign in which he said, we are going to ban the unvaccinated from planes and trains, not automobiles. He didn't go the full Monty there, but we're going to ban them from planes and trains. They don't have a right to sit on a train or plane next to a vaccinated person, he said, and got cheers and applause. And you know what? He won re-election. He won re-election. And what do we take away from that? That there is a constituency in this country for violating people's rights and freedoms. So don't think that democracy will be the answer to this problem. We need to have a significant cultural change that a cultural change that supports and rallies behind free speech. And that's what I'm doing on this show. It's certainly what I'm trying to do, but I think there is a lot more work to be done. And to go back to the exclusion of my friend and colleague, Rachel Emanuel, from Justin Trudeau's press conference there, that just reinforces why government should not be able to make these unilateral decisions about who is licit and who is illicit. As a journalist, as a speaker, as an online poster, as a social media platform, as a podcast, whatever the case may be. Now, government is not always the most reliable arbiter of many things. We've all had discussions on this program, and to those of you in the comment section on many occasions, about the suite of policies the government has brought in under the auspices of saving the planet. We have the ban on plastic straws, single-use plastics, which the Supreme Court recently ruled on favorably. We have the carbon tax, which the Supreme Court has been a little bit less favorable, at least from my perspective, in its decisions on. But undergirding all of this has been a persistent claim, certainly from the government and also from activists, especially from activists, that there is a climate crisis underway. There is a climate emergency. Wildfires are happening, and despite the fact that many of them are linked to arson, you get Stephen Guilbeault saying this is a product of the climate emergency, the climate crisis. But does the evidence stand behind what is at its core a very bold claim? Kenneth Green, who is a senior fellow with the Fraser Institute and I don't know if we call him a regular, but certainly a semi-regular on this show, says there is simply no evidence backing this up. So let's dig into that. Ken, it's good to talk to you again. Thanks for coming back on.
Good to be with you.
So, I mean, we hear this fear-mongering. I know even in the legal sense, when the carbon tax fights were before the courts, you had some activists that were saying that, you know, yes, the government can do whatever it wants because this is a national emergency. But you've actually taken a more critical look at that core claim. What did you find?
Well, I'm still looking into this. The question is, we've had a lot of rhetoric, as you said. The rhetoric on climate change, particularly the risk of climate change, has ratcheted up over the years from a concern, an imminent concern, a looming concern, to it's happening now, to it's happening now extremely, to we're in a climate crisis, and we have a climate emergency. And that the language has been getting stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger, seemingly with every electoral cycle or every political cycle. But when you go to the underlying source materials, when you look at the United Nations IPCC hard science work, their science volume of their omnibus IPCC reports on the state of climate change, what you find is that the data is not there to back up the levels of certainty that we're getting from our politicians, right? So the politicians are saying, we know this, it's proven, it's happening now, we've seen it. And that's the kind of thing that is really not clear from the underlying data, where if you look at the trends for extreme weather events, for example, as I talk about in the column we're based on today, yes, there seems to be globally, there has been an increase in warm weather events or in weather events where they're warmer in the summertime, warmer in the wintertime, right? Greater highs, less low lows, things like that. But when you start moving into the other indicators like floods and like droughts and like tropical, like hurricanes or tropical cyclones, like wildfire season, which is of course something that's top of mind for Canadians still, what you find is that the data, when you look there, is highly fragmentary. There's data in some parts of the world, but many others are not even measured. The data is inconsistent. There are some trends that are going up, have gone up, and some that have gone down over the same trend in droughts or cyclones and landfalling hurricanes and their intensities and things like that. Wildfire risk, as we showed in other papers that we've written, wildfire in Canada, wildfires are down in number and extent. And also globally, there's no trend in wildfire area and extent or fire season expansion or worsening of fire seasons. So, the problem here is we're being oversold on the confidence and the meaning of the limited amount of data available for the changes in these trends. But the underlying source, like the IPCC, again, they're actually much more modest than our politicians are. When you look at their data, they say they have medium confidence. They have a lot of low confidence in some of these indicators having been seen to change even since 1950.
Yeah, I mean, the IPCC is an interesting part of this, though, because I know that there have been criticisms leveled that the data in the IPCC report say one thing, but the executive summary says another. And you have a lot of what, you know, we would call in the media business editorializing on what the figures are actually saying there. And certainly politicians, as you note, are guilty of that. I mean, it used to be maybe a little over a decade ago before then, that global warming was the threat. It was global warming. And that was easily understood because we all know what a temperature is. You know, 22 is warmer than 20. And then the narrative changed to climate change. And all of a sudden, everything is a symptom of that. If it's really cold one day, that's also the same problem as if it's really warm one day, if it's windy. And at a certain point, what we used to just call weather is now indicative of a climate crisis.
Yeah, and I mean that's a problem. I mean, I don't have a big problem with the change in the terminology from global warming to climate change, because it's still called global warming at the heart. It's the it's the changes that manifest because it's warming that is now the focus and has been in the last 15 years. But back to the IPCC, I mean, you're right, which is when you look at the IPCC reports. First of all, there are these incredible three-volume sets that come out around every 5 years. They're what they call assessment reports.
And thousands of contributors
is dedicated to the science of climate change, and it's quite rigorous. And pretty much everybody on any side of the issue of climate issues tends to agree it does its best to be a genuine summation of the state of the physical basis and physical knowledge about climate change. But that's not the part the politicians read or base their views on. They read the summaries of those technical reports. And then they read summaries of the summaries that are specifically for policymakers that are written with an eye toward answering policymaker questions about how they can get their policies implemented, right? The basis of their policies. And so you have to dig fairly deep to see that you're being told that something is highly certain when in fact it's highly uncertain. And yet the solutions that are being proposed are so draconian that you would expect the government to actually be basing them on seriously hard, rigorous data of and knowledge of risk that can be averted. So there is a mismatch there between what the politicians read in their summaries and what they say from those summaries and the actual underlying data around the world.
So explain to me, when we hear the rhetoric of crisis, what are they citing? Like, is it that they're making a claim and they're using spurious evidence, or are they kind of just making it without even providing an attempt at evidence?
They're primarily making it without attempting to provide a definition of what a crisis is or the evidence. They were going with tipping points for a long time. I don't know if you noticed, but tipping points was a big deal for the last 7 or 8 years. It was tipping point, which haven't been met, so they dropped their tipping points, and now we're going with a climate crisis. But you know, to me, of course, a crisis is a suddenness. A crisis is something that happens in the moment. It's not a problem that is playing out over 100 years. It's a problem that's going to start manifesting itself or significantly tomorrow. That's a crisis. You have a crisis right now. When the sea level is rising so slowly that you could actually crawl away from it faster than it's rising over the next 100 years, that's not a climate crisis. If you had, you know, a 0.1% increase in hurricane wind speeds, but they're not making landfall, that's not a crisis. So they're evoking a crisis. I think mostly it's a crisis of the fact that their governments are failing to get support for their policies. And the policies are proving to be much more harmful than good. So it's more of a climate crisis of government policy than it is of the actual climate.
Yeah, and I think that is the critical point here. And we've seen, and I may be pulling you more into a political realm than you're comfortable being here, so feel free to run the other direction if you need to. But it does seem the government has really started adopting a lot of the language that we used to only have from a relatively small set of activists on this.
Yes, and I wouldn't limit it to Canada's government either. It's governments around the world, but as I've said, governments have been ratcheting up this rhetoric on climate change over the years, in proportion to how sort of extreme their policies are in the way that the policies would impact people's lives, their economy, their standard of living, and so knowing that these policies are more and more intrusive and more draconian in terms of their impact on people's lives, it seems like the political world has brought the rhetoric up to try to support that by making the rhetoric more harsh and more worrisome over time. That's not, and I don't think that's political, because all politicians do it, regardless of whether they're whatever their issue is of that they feel is important. They pretty much all oversell their confidence and the importance of their issues. So, but yeah, I mean, it is you wouldn't have seen people other than Greta Thunberg and Al Gore making these kind of full throated, exhortations of, my God, we're all going to die if we don't act immediately. These things were John Kerry. They were, like I said, Al Gore. To have them coming from environment ministers is somewhat new, but it's not unheard of either.
So the upshot here really is that, you know, the extreme weather narrative just itself lacks the underlying data, is it not?
Yes, it does. There is data here and there from around the world over certain periods of time and trends where there have been increases in observed extreme weather. There's also increases decreases in extreme weather events. And of course, that's the norm for the Earth. The Earth is not a static system, right? So over any given period of time, the UN starts from 1950 for these indicators, because that's when the data started being measured well. From between 1950 and now, you'll have lots of 10 and 20 and 30 and 40 year periods where the one trend goes up before it turns down, another trend is going down before it turns up. It always has to be kept in mind. It's a very big Earth. It's a very small pool of people able to measure the climate system on Earth, and the technology to measure it with is limited. And so there really needs to be some more humility about when we're talking in blanket statements about what's happening with the climate. It displays a distinct lack of humility.
All right. Well, fascinating piece in the Calgary Sun that you had, Kenneth Green, senior fellow with the Fraser Institute. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I want to just, before we go to our next guest, I want to talk about corporate Canada and lobbyists and lobbying and all of that. We'll have Aaron Woodrick joining us in a few moments' time, but I want to circle back to the online harm stuff, because I didn't get a chance to play this one clip, which was actually quite a strong one that was on my colleague Harrison Faulkner's show, the Faulkner Show. I'm not going to besmirch someone for an unoriginal name on the Andrew Lawton Show, but the Faulkner Show, he had on it a fascinating interview with David Thomas, who's a lawyer and formerly the chair of the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, which is the body that will ultimately be adjudicating all of these speech crimes that Bill C-63 brings into the Canadian Human Rights Act. And this is a guy who, he was literally at the helm of the body that would be adjudicating these. Now, he's no longer on it, which is why he can speak out about these things. But his words, I think, are incredibly important here. Take a look.
People are going to be afraid to say what they want. They're going to be afraid to post things online. They're going to be afraid to say things at an all candidates debate or something like that. They're going to be very mindful about what might be the consequences of this legislation. And I think this is the really unfair thing about this, right? I mean, if you really want to do something to protect people, you have to be clear. And it's a cop out for politicians to throw a vague, lousy definition of hate speech out there and just say, oh, it'll take care of itself. The damage that will be caused in the meantime will be immense, and it will be a chilling effect for everybody in this country. And there's some really interesting changes, Harrison, that I want to talk about, like in terms of what the penalties are, right? So right now, if the tribunal finds that somebody has breached the Canadian Human Rights Act and they've done something that's discriminatory, the tribunal member can award up to $20,000 for pain and suffering, and they can award another $20,000 if the conduct of the respondent was willful and reckless. Now, under these new proposed changes to the Act for hate speech, the tribunal can award up to $20,000 for any victim identified, right? So who's that, right? Is that the person that brought the complaint? Is it everybody on the internet that saw a video or a post that was considered to be hate speech? Like, who is that? So that's the first question I have. The second point is that, and this is really unusual, is that the tribunal can then award, if somebody had willful intent to commit hate speech, they can impose a fine up to $50,000, which is payable to the government of Canada.
It's unreal when you think of it. To go back to the point I started off on here about how Canadians, I think, are overwhelmingly going to go along with something like this. And I hope that the Conservatives, as the only party that's really said it's going to stand opposed to this, and certainly those of us in the civil society space that are opposing this, I hope we do a lot to turn around what Canadians think hate speech is. Because that's the linchpin of all of this. It's that, sure, we can all stand up and say, oh, yes, we think hate's bad and, you know, hate speech is bad and all that. But if we don't have a universal definition of what that is, I mean, I don't want to list a bunch of examples of things that may be hate speech and may not be hate speech, because then I know that, you know, Press Progress is just going to, like, take all of the context away and just show a clip of Andrew saying something bad. I say enough bad things. Why do you need to do this? But that's going to be what ends up happening here. And it really comes down to the fundamental point. Do you trust the government to make this determination? To bring in Aaron Woodrick on this, he is the head of the domestic policy program at the McDonald Laurier Institute. It's always good to talk to him. Aaron, I want to talk to you about corporate Canada and lobbying in a few moments, but just on this bill, I mean, what do you think the weakness is that's going to turn Canadians against this? Because I'm not sure if the fundamental question of free speech is as galvanizing as perhaps I would like it to be in the general population.
Yeah, I think but I do think this idea of hate, right, as being something easily defined and being able to, I mean, if people who read, the lawyers who read this bill, I mean, the government and the minister insist that it's a very clear line. Everyone knows the difference between, you know, mere disdain and sort of disgust. I mean, most people don't feel that way. And I think the nefarious thing about this bill is that it is going to achieve a chill on speech just out of an abundance of precaution, right? Like, if you're a platform or you're an individual and you're not sure where the line is, you're probably going to stay really far back from the line. And the result of that is a chilling on speech. And that's a bad thing. That is a bad thing. We want to have maximum robust discussion on things, even if it's offensive, even if it's uncomfortable. And the idea that we're not going to worry about a fuzzy line and that the judges will figure it out later is very, very alarming language from this government. So I actually think this bill is, there's a bunch of things. It's a bunch of bills actually all joined together. They could be separate bills. You've seen the stuff about the, you know, the child protection and child abuse and sort of inducing child bullying. That stuff could be its own bill. And frankly, a lot of that stuff is perfectly fine. A lot of it's already illegal. You know, if they want to expand it, it should be its own bill. But rolling in this nebulous idea of hate and tasking the tribunals of all bodies to identify it is just going to lead to a disaster. It was a disaster in the past under the old rules for the tribunal, and it is going to be a disaster if they bring this bill back in.
Yeah, and I don't want to bring it up, actually, because I haven't read too much into it. So I'll revisit what I was about to say on the show tomorrow. But, you know, I could see very much this being weaponized against a politician, perhaps. I mean, let's say you have an upstart political party like we have in Europe that wants to take a particular approach on immigration, perhaps the People's Party in Canada with Maxime Bernier. You know, you get some overzealous complainant that wants to make a point and says this rhetoric is hateful. You all of a sudden have the political process potentially being brought in under this. And I think that's incredibly dangerous, especially when, as you note, and as we've talked about on the show, there's such an unclear line as to when content becomes hateful.
Yeah, and let's not forget the bodies that are adjudicating this, right? Some of the folks, the people on the tribunal, are not lawyers, or they're very junior lawyers. Tribunals are not courts. They don't have the same rules as courts. And one of the glaring examples under this bill would be the right to bring complaints anonymously, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Part of the whole the process in the rule under the rule of law and through the court system is you have the right to know who your accuser is and what you're being accused of. A lot of these rules go out the window. It's a bit of a like funhouse mirror court system in tribunals. People need to realize this. And part of the reason that they have to kick things like vague notions like hate to a tribunal is because under a court system, under court rules, none of these complaints would ever succeed. And so it's almost an admission that these things aren't quite illegal and aren't quite criminal. So we need to send them to this body where there's kind of loosey-goosey rules in order for them to get anywhere. And it all boils down to, you know, the government trying to, I do believe at this point, the government's goal is to chill speech. They want to chill speech because they think it's a good thing, because it would be better if we had fewer people saying nasty things. I think that's a very pinched view. I think they are discounting the value of robust free exchange, even if it's not always pleasant, even if we don't always like everything everyone says. We have to protect free speech, and I just don't think this government is that committed to it.
Yeah, fair enough. Let's turn to this speech that Pierre Poilievre gave, I think it was Friday of last week. He spoke before the Vancouver Board of Trade, so an assembled gathering of business leaders and lobbyists, and he gave, I would not exactly say the speech that you would expect him to give before that group. He gave something reminiscent of the, you know, gravy train is over speech that Rob Ford once gave, but he never did it in the room of people that are trying to ride the gravy train. I should point out, he was the leader. He became the leader in September 2022, and he has so far not done any speech of this nature to chambers of commerce, to trade groups, and all of that. So there's something noteworthy in there. But what he said is that, like, we're not going to be beholden to lobbyists. We're not going to be beholden to big business. If you want something from my government when I'm there, you've got to make the pitch to Canadians, and it has to be in their best interest. Now, is this just political posturing, or is this a bit of a different tack than we've seen from political leaders in Canada?
Yeah, look, the proof's going to be in the pudding if and when he becomes prime minister, whether or not he can stick to his guns on this. We've certainly heard this story before. I mean, we heard Doug Ford in Ontario say that, you know, the gravy train was going to be stopped and that it was game over for corporate welfare. That never happened. So it's possible that these are just words. But I think if you look a little bit closer, and this is something that I've been banging on about since my days at the Taxpayers Federation, there is a really big difference between free enterprise, entrepreneurship, what I call pure capitalism, and what has really sort of infected business across most of the industrialized world, but in Canada in particular, is what I call cronyism or corporatism. It's this idea where, you know, business is basically leaning on government, not for the right to compete or the right to make money, but the right for favors, the right for restrictions to block competitors, the right for subsidies from taxpayers. I think a lot of Poilievre's speech was aimed at drawing the distinction between these two groups, and they are completely different groups. Andrew, in the business community in this country, there are some people who all they want is the government to leave them alone so they can go out and win customers and just, like, try and take over the world by having the best product at the best price. There are others that spend all day screaming about how they're under threat and that jobs will be lost and that we have to block competition and the government has to keep everybody out. These are very different groups with very different interests. And I think Poilievre is saying, I got no problem with the free enterprise group, but if you're in the latter group and you're used to being able to come to government and scare governments into saying, oh, if you don't do this and protect me, you know, X, Y, and Z is going to happen. He's saying, I got a message for you. That's not going to work with me. So again, we'll see if he can stick to his guns on that, but it is certainly a different message than we've heard from most politicians in the past.
What's the charitable, if there is one, what's the charitable defense of corporate lobbyists?
Yeah, well, it's don't play, as like I wrote in the piece, it's don't hate the player, hate the game, right? And I truly do mean this. A lot of these lobbyists and a lot of these businesses have no choice but to basically take some of the handouts, because if they don't, their competitor will. So even businesses that start, they don't even intend to lobby, they don't want to spend any time lobbying or thinking about lobbying, they kind of have to join the race. Otherwise, they get left behind because you've got a competitor that's going and taking a subsidy or taking advantage of a loophole or a special privilege. So you create this sort of perverse incentives. And make no mistake, politicians caused this. If you had government, I mean, they're so used to, business is so used to politicians offering goodies that they've become used to it. It's like the ducks at the park. If you start feeding them bread all the time, they don't fly south anymore, right? They just stick around and expect you to feed them bread. And governments have been giving businesses the free bread for so long that they just sort of expect it as a matter of course. So they have to stop doing that. It will be a painful process. I'm not going to lie. But if they can do that, I think that in the medium and long run, that'd be very good for Canadian business.
Well, and you see it at the government level as well, where governments will defend their own handouts by appealing to globalization. They'll be like, oh, well, if we don't give Volkswagen billions of dollars in subsidies, some other country will, and then we don't get the plant. So it really is a race to the bottom across the board.
It is. And there's always this implicit argument that, well, we have to be in the business of doing X, right? If we're building X here now, we can't not have that anymore. Well, we actually can. And guess what? If X goes, something else might come. I mean, the examples I give are Australia used to build cars. Now they don't. Their economy did not suffer. Other types of businesses started up. They didn't experience a recession. Another example, BlackBerry for my hometown. And BlackBerry, you know, they had to cut 90% of their workforce. They didn't ask for a handout like Bombardier to stay afloat. And guess what happened? All those people that were let go, a lot of them started new businesses and created a whole new ecosystem. So this is part of the whole creative destruction. This is part of the processes of a market. Not everyone can win all the time. And when business leaders insist that, no, we have to freeze all the businesses we have here right now, today, they're kind of showing their hand that they don't have the confidence that they're able to compete in the marketplace. And I think, if politicians are only listening to business people that are afraid and not the ones that are ambitious, that's a real problem.
Yeah, you are right. There tends to be an ahistorical element to this where we forget that we didn't keep the horse and buggy industry on life support indefinitely. We forget that we didn't keep, maybe we are keeping the newspaper industry, but in general, we aren't clinging as much to an antiquated mode of that. And it is so weird because you're right. There tends to be this move towards stagnation in the political rhetoric that forgets all of the things we've moved beyond in the past. Like, I don't know if anyone's lamenting the lost typewriter manufacturers of our previous era.
Yeah, but you can appreciate why politically, a bird in the hand's worth two in the bush, right? So if you you're an MP and you're in a community that's got a factory that employs 1,000 people, it's all fine and well to say, well, the factory goes, something else will pop up somewhere.
Yeah, the Fenelon Hall typewriter manufacturer, if you're the MP for there, is the backbone of the economy. Yeah,
and I understand that, and that's why I have some sympathy, is that they're kind of in a box. But I think we need to take that big picture, and politicians who have to govern for the country as a whole, right, can't be captive of this. Now, I will say one thing, Andrew, is that there are certain sectors, if there's sort of national security issues, maybe we need different rules for those. There can be carve outs from this sort of general lean towards competition and free trade. So I'm not saying there should be no exceptions, but I'm saying that has to be the general rule. And the more we drift away from that, the more, sometimes it's Canadians that end up suffering for it.
Yeah, and we might end up being on the precipice of turning a corner on this. I mean, not to draw a false parallel, but Pierre Poilievre speaking at that Board of Trade meeting reminded me in a way of Javier Milei at the World Economic Forum a few weeks back, of just going in there and making what you've just described, that unbridled defense of the free market and capitalism. And one of the points Javier Milei gave was that you should never feel guilty about making a profit. You should never feel guilty about being successful in business. And I think that's the spirit we need to inject into Canadian business, which I think Canadian business is different from corporate Canada. They are two separate entities.
And some of that's already there. And I bet you in that room at the Vancouver Board of Trade, half the room was terrified by what Poilievre was saying, but the other half loved it. Right. And it even varies within companies and within sectors. You have people that take these different views, to be, again, charitable to the corporate view. It's more of a practical view. I think a lot of those people, in private would acknowledge, what I'm saying is correct. But they just sort of say, look, I got to operate in the real world. And so that's why I have to do what I do. But I'm saying, listen, if we change the game, maybe we won't have to hate the players anymore either. And hopefully Poilievre can stick to his word and help sort of usher in that change in our business culture.
Yeah, very well said. Aaron Woodrick, McDonald Laurier Institute, Domestic Policy Director. Good to talk to you as always, sir.
Thanks a lot, Andrew.
Thank you, Aaron. Yeah, it's funny. I had this conversation with, I forget who it was, actually. It was someone in my family. It might have actually been my wife. We're talking about cell phone plans and just how infuriating it is that whenever you want to renew your cell phone contract, you always have to go through this labyrinthian network of customer service advisors to get the best deal possible. Now, some people, if your time is worth more to you than my time evidently is to mine, you may just go on the website and say, okay, this is the cost per month, I'm going to pay that. But if you call, you're going to get another price. And if you call and ask to speak to the loyalty and retention department, you're going to get yet another price. And if you hold out, you're probably going to get yet another price from them. I can't even remember now. I have an insane phone deal because I just waited them out. But it pained me. And it bothered me that they don't just say, here's the price and that's it. And everyone pays the same thing. And I'm not one of these radical egalitarians that doesn't think there should be latitude or flexibility. But the point is that when they do this, this becomes what Aaron was talking about, the rules of the game. This becomes the way the game is played. And then everyone does it, because if no one does it, then you're not going to be being treated as well as other people. And it becomes a race to the bottom, but I think everyone loses out. So there is something to be said about a leader that's going to come in and say, we're not going to play the lobbyist game. This is our vision. This is our pitch. If you want something, make it to Canadians and not to me, because you're not going to win me over. So good to see that in the Vancouver Board of Trade speech that Pierre Poilievre gave last week. We will wrap things up here, but we'll be back in tomorrow. I'm just losing the ability to speak right now. We will be back tomorrow in 23 hours and 50 minutes. We will talk to you then. Thank you. God bless. And good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.